Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today, as befits a program on the radio that concerns science, we're going to talk a little bit about communication of science. Do scientists like to communicate what they do to the lay public? Does the lay public even want to hear what scientists have to say about themselves and their activities? Well, I'm totally biased on this, but we've got an expert today. His name is Professor John Besley. He's from Michigan State, and he's in the College of Communications, Arts, and Science. And so he's an expert on all this stuff. So, John, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you should feel right at home here. We're just
trying to
communicate science to the lay public.
Absolutely. No, it's something I like studying, and it's something, you know, I'm always happy to take part in.
Jolly good. Well, before we get into that and sort of listen to your erudition and expertise, why don't we learn a little bit about John Besley?
Sure.
How did you grow up? What are the things that led you to a career in science communication?
Yeah, so you never know how you get where you're going. But I'm Canadian, but I'm at Michigan State. My dad's a doctor. My mom had her master's in pharmacology, and he left Toronto. My family left Toronto after med school, moved up to the small town sort of north of Toronto where people go on vacation, and it's beautiful. Georgian Bay.
Oh, I know Parry Sound very well.
Our family
have a cottage up
right around
there.
The bay.
Yes.
And so it's just a nice place. And we grow up, you know, boating and doing all the outdoor stuff that comes along with living up there. So, you know, always sort of thought I would do a science degree. And in fact, when I finished high school, I applied to an engineering program, a biology program, and a journalism program because I still didn't know at that point. And I had good enough grades. I knew where I could choose, but somehow I ended up choosing the journalism. I thought that I would do journalism with a double major in journalism and biology. It turns out that's really hard to do just because the courses all conflict. And so, you know, at that point, I'd started working at the student paper at my university, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought, I can be a science writer, a science communicator. And so I was doing that for a while.
Which university did you go to, John?
Carleton University in Ottawa.
Okay, in Ottawa, right.
Yeah, so they're one of the oldest journalism schools in Canada. Actually, I think it is the oldest journalism school in Canada. And so I finished my journalism degree. I'm still, you know, I'm freelancing, and I spend the summer at a newspaper up on near Niagara Falls. And I thought, no, I'm gonna go back and get my master's in policy because I want to be good at this. I want to really understand. I was sort of politics and science, and I want to understand not just journalism, but like, get a little deeper. And so I did this master's degree in science policy. And somehow, instead of continuing in journalism, that actually ended up leading me to work for Environment Canada for a couple of years. And I was the guy who sort of tried to compile things and write talking points for the minister and the deputy minister and, you know, the various leaders.
Well, that sounds quite exciting, actually. You know, but it didn't appeal to you enough to stay on with that.
You know, it was great. It was interesting. And I was in the international group, so I got to travel around, and that was cool. But the problem was, so if you do a science policy or an environment policy degree, you have all these things that you want to do. Like, oh, we could do this, and that would make a big difference. But nobody wants them. No, but there's no public. People blame the politicians for not being tough enough. But really, the politicians would be happy to do it, at least the ones I worked with, if there was some demand for it. And so I got interested in this idea of also, what does the public want, and why do they want things? And so I had a contact at Cornell who was doing environmental communication. Lo and behold, I find myself in a PhD program at Cornell, across the border, moved to the United States, 2002. Unfortunately, there's no money at that time for environmental public opinion research, environmental communication research. But there was money to study public opinion about genetic engineering, agricultural biotechnology, Cornell being a big ag school.
So the money leads the discipline here, right?
Well, you know, but it turns out, the good thing of this is that if you're thinking about communication, you're thinking about being like scientific about how you do your communication, it actually doesn't matter what topic you're communicating about. The concepts are the same. Whether it's, oh, you know, I get my PhD, I study, start studying GMOs, public opinion, but I ultimately end up doing my dissertation research on public perceptions of cancer clusters. The concepts are the same, right? The underlying communication concepts, what makes good, effective communication, doesn't matter whether I'm doing genetic modified food, which I still enjoy doing, or nuclear energy, which I have done a little bit of research on, nanotechnology. A lot of people in my world started studying nanotechnology, you know, about when there is the National Nanotechnology Initiative. That's actually a really hard thing to study public opinion about because there is no public opinion. but yeah, and so we sort of go from things that people are, one thing that people are afraid of to another thing.
Well, tell me, you mentioned several things there. One of them intrigues me a little bit, and this you call them cancer clusters, but it could be name your disease clusters.
Sure, absolutely.
And in many places in the world, it looks like a cluster, and so people are convinced straight away that there's something in that particular locale which is responsible, as opposed to just the nature of statistics. Discuss that a little bit from what you understood.
And actually, that's what made it such an interesting thing for me to study. So what I'm really interested in that sense, is if I'm interested in communication effectiveness, those are great situations where public health groups, agencies would go in and they would do an investigation, and almost invariably they would find that, yeah, you know, this is elevated, that's not, we don't see a pattern. And so the only thing they had going, they couldn't control the outcome of the research. The researcher was going to say what the research did. The only thing that the public health groups could do at that point was communicate well. They had to run a procedure, an investigation and a communication procedure around that investigation that was perceived as being fair. Fair in terms of how they treated people, fair in terms of the degree to which they listened to people. The outcome was out of their hands. And so it was a great sort of set of natural experiments to really look at the effect of, is it worth putting resources into doing communication well? And it is.
I mean, can you give us an example of where, at the beginning of the authorities trying to communicate about a cluster, that the opinion in the area was, we've been duped, there's something in our environment that's causing this, and yet at the end they began to understand that perhaps this wasn't the case?
So my favorite meeting, I went to Northampton, Massachusetts. There was one of the old tech companies had sort of dumped things they shouldn't have dumped in various parts around Northampton. And so there's a public health meeting, and the first half of the meeting is pretty standard. You know, a couple of folks came up from the Capitol to give a PowerPoint presentation, and they went through it, and people sat through it. But then, break, and it comes in, and then these two folks, this is classic New England. It's like in an old schoolhouse. They sit on the table and they just start talking to the community, and you could see that, you know, as that conversation went on, these two investigators, they knew about this community, and they showed that they knew, like, oh, you know, that, you know, this old guy's farm, yeah, we were back in there, yeah, and it was just a great demonstration. And of course, you know, we do the survey research afterwards, and yeah, and in fact, you know, in that community, people do still have faith in
authorities,
public health authorities. But it was the best example I have of. You could just see the room change when these two women sat down and started talking with the community, showed that they cared deeply about figuring this thing out, showed that they cared deeply about the community and had done the work to do the investigation. It wasn't just, yeah, here's the numbers, and we're not finding anything, and we're sorry we're not finding anything, but we're trying really hard.
Well, that's a classic example of the Toronto fellow Marshall McLuhan, the medium and the message. The message isn't so important. It's how it's delivered.
The message can be ignored if it's not showing that you care. If you can show that you care, people will infer from that correctly. I mean, this is always a dangerous thing, right? I really believe that people can tell if you're lying about caring. And so if you really do care, I mean, often one of the things we say in the science comm sort of training thing is, don't hide the fact that you care. Don't pretend that you're some sort of science robot. Like, if you care, show it, because that stuff matters.
Well, let's talk specifics. I'm a chemist. Mm-hmm. You're a communicator. And I had the privilege of listening to one of your presentations just recently at the American Chemical Society National Meeting.
I was happy to be invited.
Yeah, and you had some really interesting data that sort of illustrated the sort of range of desire, if you like, of different scientists and different disciplines to communicate. So why don't you give our listening audience a sort of a quick précis of that, and then try to find out what you think are the reasons for this.
Yeah. And so we have a project going on now with a colleague from University of Texas in Austin, Anthony Dudo. So the biggest part of this is a big survey of scientists from a bunch of different, 8 different scientific societies. And we're asking them about, have they done sort of public communication? Have they engaged with the public? Often we talk about science communication as public engagement. Have they done something to try to communicate with adults in their communities or nationally? And so what we find is that different societies have different amounts of communication. And so we had a social scientist society, and those guys were the ones that were the most likely to have communicated. The ecological society that we surveyed, their members were pretty likely to have communicated too. As you mentioned, the chemistry folks were a little less likely. They were you know, these aren't huge differences, but they were a little less likely to communicate. They were also a little. We also asked about willingness to communicate. Would you be willing? You know, if somebody asked, would you be willing to do it in the future? And they were the same sort of pattern. And so, the question is why would that be?
Well, if I can interject, I mean, clearly, people in social sciences, that's all they ever seem to do. Is, you know, surveys and understanding, and to do that, you've got to have an awful lot of interaction with the public.
We have to have interaction with the public, and, you know, I feel fortunate that, so my father-in-law is a neurophysiologist, and when I go to parties, nobody wants to talk about neurophysiology. They want to talk about what's in the media and what people, they want to talk about people. People like to talk about people, and so we're fortunate in that we're often in areas that, yeah, maybe there's a little, it's easier for people to talk about it. The downside of this is everybody feels like they're a communication expert.
Of course.
It might be sort of a more inherent interest or easy, it might be a little bit easier for some of those folks. But yeah, there's a chemistry folks, you know, it's a little, we had two groups. We had a chemistry society and a biochemistry society, and they were both the two that were sort of at the lower end of past engagement and willingness to engage. And so what we you can look at it, and so we ask a bunch of other questions, and so attitudes towards engagement, do they think it would be fun? And they're a little lower on that. We ask whether or not they think their colleagues would approve of it. And I don't think there's much difference there. You know, the biggest thing, though, that we find that makes anybody, any scientist, willing to engage seems to be what we call efficacy, but it's really like, it's skill. Do they feel like they can do a good job? And when you feel like you can do a good job at something, you're going to be more likely to do it. And this is sort of, as part of this project, this has sort of led us down to the world of there's sort of a group of, maybe there's a community of 50 people crisscrossing the country giving science communication training. And on campuses around the country, there are people, grad students and faculty members who are trying to figure out how to get more training for communication. A lot of what our research is showing is that if you make people feel like they can do a good job, they're more likely to do it.
Tell me a little bit about that training. Who's putting this on? I mean,
sure.
Is there a national science communication training organization?
There is not. No. So American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is like the big, you know, they publish science. They're
right.
the general science society. So they have a group there that does a leadership role. There's a group out called Compass that does, you know, they do a lot of sort of fellowship programs for different groups. They're pretty active. And then there's books. Randy Olson, Don't Be Such a Scientist. He's written three books now on science communication, and he goes around and gives training.
It's always amazing to me that you can write a book, and then you can write another book, and you can write a third book,
you know,
and it's all about the same subject. Right?
You know, you find some. The other group, I should say, is the Alan. I would hate to forget the Alan Alda Institute at Stony Brook. They're doing all kinds of neat things, both on training and in
their, and it helps to have a famous name, does it not?
Oh, and he's passionate about the
right.
whole. I mean, the thing again, the passion thing. I mean, he's so clearly passionate that he's really compelling. There's a lot of folks, for good or ill, who are, you know, setting up their own training. And this is really where we're sort of interested right now is, so there's one thing about quantity. How do you get more scientists to communicate? Quantity is good, but the thing that we would argue that really matters is quality or effectiveness. If you're going to spend your time, everybody's busy. Scientists are busy. They have stuff they want to do. They have demands on their time. And so how do you make sure that if you're doing communication, that it has the effect you want it to have? I mean, that's where we're really turning our attention.
Okay. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest at the other end of the line is John Besley, Michigan State College of Communications and Science. And we're talking about science and communication. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell and John Besley, Michigan State, from the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences. And we were talking about this whole business of scientists trying to communicate. Do they want to? Are they good at it? And, you know, I can tell sort of apocryphal stories. I like to play pool. And it's usually about 10, 11 at night. And sooner or later, someone asks, you know, well, what do you do? I say, well, by day I'm a chemist, right? But by evening I'm studying physics. I want to make sure the angle of incidence and reflection with the ball here is all appropriate. And it's interesting. At that time of night, people don't particularly have so many inhibitions about chemistry. Earlier in the day, they may have. And so where am I going with this? I think that there's perhaps a belief among scientists that we don't need to communicate, or that our attempts to communicate would be not favored by the lay community.
We sort of run into this thing where people think that there's some sort of war on science going on, a broad-based war on science. National Geographic had a cover story called The War on Science. Now, if you went and actually read the story, that term wasn't really used. But there's this idea that somehow science is under siege. And so the biggest thing that I can say, so I write this report every couple of years on behalf of the National Science Board that has sort of this best data on it's science literacy, but also attitudes towards science. And there's this measure that's been asked since the 1970s about confidence in a whole bunch of different groups. Two of the groups are medicine and the scientific community. And it turns out most of the groups, actually, and journalists and politicians, and most of the groups have experienced a decline in how people feel about them. That is not true for one group, and that group is science. Science is maintained near the top. I think they're second place right now, near the top, and the group in society that most people have the most confidence in. And so this idea that somehow scientists are under siege, it's not true. Now, it is true that they're within some subgroups, that confidence has gone down, and that's a problem. But it's also a problem, maybe, of some of our own making. It is absolutely true that there are issues on which science and political parties disagree. But, you know, that's always going to be the case. I guess the question becomes then, like, so what do you do when you have a disagreement? Do you call people idiots? Do you get angry and attack people? Or are there other paths?
So what you're saying here is that just the facts alone, and that goes back to our earlier conversation, just having the correct data and the correct message, if you don't do it well, if you don't show that you really genuinely are thinking on both sides of the argument, you won't get very far. Education by itself is not enough.
So I have yet to see much evidence that I can teach somebody to like something. If I just give them enough facts about X or Y topic that I can get them... You know, I play pool, too, and I haven't convinced them. I hear some facts about pool, and it hasn't worked. And so there's other things going on, right? There's other things. I didn't teach my wife to love me. I mean, she learned things about me. There's no question about that, that maybe made her like me more or less. But that's not how people work. And so you have to balance this interest. I mean, the reason that scientists get invited to talk to people, though, of course, is that they have information to share. And I use the word share really... outside of the classroom, once you leave the university, people don't come to scientists to be filled up with information. They want scientists to share what they're learning, what it might mean, how they're thinking about issues. And, you know, people expect to have a chance to talk to and say what they're thinking when they hear that. And those that two-way dialogue, that conversation around science that's respectful, that's open, that's honest, I think that's where communication is going and needs to go.
Do you have up in Michigan, in where you're at Michigan State, are there in your area things like science cafes? Do you have any experience with those as an idea to sort of bring some expert on something that's reasonably good at communication, may have some show and tell, and then inviting the public to come and sample the wares?
Yeah, my first experience with science cafe was at Cornell. And it was during the Mars mission when they had just first gotten there, and there was a faculty member at Cornell who was a big part of that project. And we were at a pub, and he had a beer in one hand and a slide projector thing in the other hand, and he was talking about, he was showing these beautiful pictures of Mars and talking about his research, and it was awesome. Funny you should mention it. We're in the process of building out the MSU's, Michigan State's, science communication training work, and as part of that is to institute some sort of science cafe. I think there's a lot of interest in that, and we have some partners around town. We have a great like a kids focused science center that would be very happy to have us come in the evening. And
so you have a children's science museum of some type?
Yeah, Impression 5. It's great. I take my kids there, but in the evening it's kind of just sitting there, and So we did actually last year, sort of as a trial, we just had people from my college, people who study communication for a living, did a series of talks that we would call it 7 and 7, 7 talks, 7 minutes each, about what they're doing. And there was beer, and there was wine, and there was food, and people had a good time. And so we want to expand that out, different colleges, maybe different locations, depending
so
on...
So something like that, let me interject, something 7 at 7, or 7 times 7, whichever, that would last quite a long time, because you've got to engender questions. So this is almost a two-hour operation, I would think.
Yeah, it's an evening, yeah? Right?
Yeah,
and we do, and MSU, of course, has a science festival, where we have the first science festival in Michigan, which we do in East Lansing, but we also do in Detroit. And so that's a similar thing, more kids-focused, though we also are very careful in that to have adult events. I love the science festival idea, and the science cafe is the same thing, because, you know, we have book festivals to celebrate books, and we have music festivals to celebrate music, so let's celebrate science. We're not teaching people stuff, we're celebrating science.
So these Say It at 7 programs, how often do you have them?
So we did them during the science festival, and we did one last year just as a trial for sort of a bigger thing, but our plan is to do them monthly, but we're... You know, it's. I think like a lot of places, we're building this up. The science communication, we sometimes call it the science of science communication, as an area is building. And so it's one thing to do the science communication things. I want this because I want to study it. I want to study the effect of these things. We don't know. There's lots of things we don't know about how these things are going to shape people's
views. Well, what's the response of the Magnificent Seven that participate in this, do they all come away thinking that, boy, that was a lot of fun, can't wait to do it again? Or they come away saying, well, the beer was good, the sandwich was fine, but I'm not quite sure what it accomplished?
I think most people who do it enjoy it. I think most people who do it realize that it's harder than they thought it was to do it well. Part of our plan is to think about doing it more than once. So people get a lot of these training initiatives are about you do it a few times and to realize how hard it is to do it effectively. You watch a video of yourself doing it and you really realize, yes, there's some stuff.
Yes.
The other thing is the goals thing, though. We spend a lot of time in our current work right now thinking about, are scientists adequately setting goals for what they're doing? So if we're going to talk about effective communication, you can't have effective communication. The idea doesn't make any sense if you're not effective for what? What is your goal? What are you trying to accomplish? And so we're working with scientists, and part of this training work we're trying to do on campus, and actually a lot of our conversations with trainers across the country has been this shift towards, all right, don't just focus on skills. Don't just get people to speak more clearly. Clearly is good. We'd want people to speak with clarity. But have some desire to have an effect and figure out what that effect is. Figure out what's possible. Don't have a goal that's impossible and that you can't do it.
That leads into the whole concept of evaluation. And
Absolutely. That's
presumably part of the research that you guys do in trying to find out, well, was this intervention useful? Did it achieve anything?
Yeah, and almost none of the science communication that's going on right now is really, really evaluated. There's a group with the science festival around the country. They're starting to evaluate those more, and they're doing a great job. And so one of the reasons I'm involved here at MSU is because, we want to see what kind of effect people are having. And it's fun, right? It's an experiment. We can start making these things into its own experiments, right? So what if we do this? What if we do that? What if we compare if we get enough of them, like the 30 scientists who told stories versus the 30 scientists who didn't tell stories, did those guys have different effects? We can start thinking about it.
Absolutely. I mean, in the history of this program, you'd be just amazed. I should put it together as a sort of little booklet. When I asked you at the beginning, how did you get into your career? And that was quite straightforward. But some of the people that we've had, especially the scientifically oriented researchers, they have these tremendous stories that how they got into science. Sometimes I think they make them up. I mean, they're so entertaining. But that puts a face on the person that's talking about science. One last question. These programs like yours, you talk about them being around the nation. Is this now a program that's developing at more and more universities?
Yeah, it is. And so I was just having a conversation today with a colleague who is a woman in toxicology who wants to set up a course for toxicology students in science communication. There's a group of a couple of students at the University of Michigan down the road who are setting these up. And so I think people know... It's sort of know in a generic way that it's something that needs to be better.
But they don't know how to make it better, probably. We don't have anything that I'm aware of here.
How far are you guys from Austin?
Oh, just a mere 623 miles.
Yeah, that's what I
think.
Thought. Yeah,
it's a long way.
Yeah.
But we can check that out, and I can get back to you on that. And we've run out of time. John Besley, Michigan State, College of Communications, Arts and Sciences, Attitudes Towards Communicating Science. It's been a lot of fun, and you're a good communicator. You're easy to talk to on the radio. Now, it helps that I've seen you. That's an interesting feature there. You know, sometimes we do a program where I've never met the person. It's not as easy.
It's not, is it? It's a different... Or when you see somebody that you haven't... You hear somebody on the radio for a long time, and then you see them. It's a very... It's never what you think it's going to be.
Absolutely. But when I've seen you before I heard you on the radio, it's exactly what I expected.
You can imagine me.
Yeah, right. Hey, John Besley, thank you so much for being here. I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting on the program, and would like to thank you, the audience, for listening. Otherwise, we wouldn't be trying to communicate. Thanks very much.
Thank you.